Let's turn to God's Word together. And we're going to read just a few verses from Romans chapter 3. It's obviously, when it's a topic, a theme like this, it's often a bit difficult to know, well, which passage to look at particularly. And this is a passage which I think is very familiar to us, and we'll be picking a few of the verses out of it. But I think it also does set the tone for some of what we're wanting to consider. So Romans chapter 3, and we'll start to read verse 21. And Paul has just been basically building up the argument that we're hopeless. We have no chance. Everything is black. We're all sinners, and that's about it. But then he says, verse 21, "But now a righteousness from God, apart from law, has been made known, to which the law and prophets testify. This righteousness from God comes through faith in Jesus Christ to all who believe." Then verse 27. "Where then is the boasting? It's excluded. On what principle? On that of observing the law? No, but on that of faith. For we maintain that a man is justified by faith apart from observing the law. Is God the God of Jews only? Is he not the God of Gentiles too? Yes, of Gentiles too, since there's only one God who will justify the circumcised by faith and the uncircumcised through that same faith. Do we then nullify the law by this faith? Not at all. Rather, we uphold the law. What then shall we say that Abraham, our forefather, discovered in this matter? If, in fact, Abraham was justified by works, he had something to boast about, but not before God. What does the Scripture say? Abraham believed God, and it was credited to him as righteousness." One of the fundamentals of the Christian faith is, of course, the fundamental requirement of faith. We have to start there. Faith is central. We can't avoid that fact. As evangelicals especially, we stand in the tradition of those who were ready to die to uphold the doctrine of salvation by faith and the need for a continued life of faith. Abraham, we just read, was declared righteous because of his faith. The centrality of faith in the life of the Christian is further demonstrated by one of the other titles we go by. That's believers. That's what we are. We are those who believe, who have faith. We believe that this faith inevitably involves our minds. It's intellectual as well as so much more. But that is part of it. And therefore, we have creeds. We have statements of faith. Our faith concerns God, that he is three in one. It looks at that his actions, that he created, that he judges, that he provides, that he saves. It concerns his attributes, that he is all-powerful, all-knowing, everywhere present. One of the great early fathers of the church, Augustine, said, "Christians are those who think in believing and believe in thinking." And that's a good way to think of it, or to consider it. We think in believing. Our faith isn't just without engaging our minds, but we believe in our thinking. Our belief, what we know deep within us, affects the way we think about things. And of course, our faith is not just about certain things. It's actually in someone particular. It's about responding to what we know in our minds, relying on the reliable one. Trusting in the trustworthy one. Having faith in the faithful one. We have to know somebody's reliable before we're willing to rely on them. That they're trustworthy before we will trust them. That they are faithful before we will put our faith in them. I might know a lot about these chairs. We often use that image, isn't it? They're sort of metal frames. They've got four legs. They hold up all of you. But am I actually willing myself to sit on that chair? That is the real crux about my faith in it. It'll only be shown when I take the plunge and commit myself, like you all are, to trust in their reliability. So far, none have let us down, but who knows? I might choose the one that will suddenly break. Real faith, you see, is proved always by actions. That's the whole message of James' letter. Now, all that's very well, and I'm sure that most, if not all of us here, would nod to that, at least perhaps some being us, we will just grunt our assent. That's all very good, yes, jolly good. But here we come to the crunch of this evening. And the crunch is that the world of the Christian is not fairy tale. It's not make-believe. It's not, we'd like to think that was the case, so let's pretend it is. And if we get enough people all pretending the same thing, won't it be great? And that will surely make it happen. That isn't what the Christian life is about. We live as weak individuals in the real world and find all too often that an unwelcome but all too frequent companion in our Christian faith, Christian life, is doubt. It comes in for all of us, I would imagine. And for all the fact that we know that faith is so important, we are at times plagued with doubt. And because of what we know concerning faith's importance, we find that we are overwhelmed with guilt when those doubts come. I shouldn't be like that. I better not tell anybody else. I'm not sure if that's where I am, but everybody else seems so certain, and so on. And guilt comes in. It felt right, considering the fact we were looking at Thomas this morning, and as Oliver said, he's often referred to as Doubting Thomas, that we always think of him, when he's talked about as Doubting Thomas, it's referred to as a critical thing, isn't it? As a critical tone in that description. People even say, who have no idea who Thomas is or that he comes from the Bible, say, don't be a Doubting Thomas, because that's negative, isn't it? So was he really so wrong to doubt? Is it something which really he shouldn't have done? Our faith is central, but we doubt. And there are at least a couple of reasons, I think, why it's important that we do consider this subject. First of all, because we live in an age of skepticism, an age where doubt is the way people are, where most people are placed. People are often, as you're all aware, I'm sure, with your non-Christian friends or family, very happy to talk about spiritual things. And the thorough materialism of a few decades ago has really dissipated a bit, hasn't it? People realize there's more to life than just stuff. At least they say that until the stores have their sales and things. Then suddenly stuff becomes incredibly important again. But while that materialism might have disappeared, unfortunately, it hasn't been replaced by a wonderfully clear faith, a wonderfully clear sense of, but this is what is right, what we should be living for. And any talk of certainty in our faith brings out that strongest of objections and even opposition, doesn't it, from people? We're allowed to believe what we like as long as we don't claim to believe it is the truth. And that mentality means that we need to think hard about how to deal with a generation of which we are a part, which is marked by doubt rather than trust. That's one reason it's important to look at it. The other reason, of course, is, as I said earlier, in a sense, we all experience doubts. I would imagine would anybody like to stand and say that they just never doubt? Probably because you just don't want to stand, but even just wave a little finger. No, nobody, I don't think, I thought I was confident in saying that. We all experience doubts. We need to know then how to help those who doubt each other, and even more fundamentally, how to be honest about our own doubts. What do we do with them when they come? It's a lovely little verse in Jude, which I know everybody reads at least once a week. But the way Jude finishes his rather strange little letter in a sense. But he finishes it in verse 22 of that little letter by saying, be merciful to those who doubt. Which I think is a lovely little phrase. Be merciful. So draw alongside, help those who doubt, it says. The philosopher Descartes came up with the statement, cogito ergo sum, I think, therefore I am. And that's often been altered to, I doubt, therefore I am. We won't get into the philosophy of all that. But actually, the reverse is also true. I am, therefore I doubt. It's part of being a human being, certainly in our culture and where we are. We say to err is human, but just as much to doubt is human. Now, this evening, I'm not planning to make any attempt to consider specific doubts, so some of those might come out when we have discussion later, and do feel free to say if there are specific things that you'd like to address, but
First of all, I think we need to face the fact that we can too easily be consumed by guilt at having any doubts at all. And therefore, we need to ask, is guilt the proper response for a Christian who is doubting? Should we be guilty when we have doubts? So what is doubt? And is it wrong? And the basic principle, really, which I hope we can grasp, is that doubt is not necessarily the opposite of belief. It's not necessarily the opposite of faith. It's not either you believe or you doubt. The opposite of belief is unbelief. Doubt is different. In those readings from Romans that we started off with, the opposite of faith was not doubt, it was works. Paul wasn't talking there about whether you sometimes question some of the central truths of Christianity. He was talking about, how do you expect to get to heaven? Is it by trusting God, receiving what he's promised, or is it by doing what you think is right? Doubt doesn't disqualify us from salvation. Legalism does that. The danger of doubt is the effect it can have on our walk, on our obedience. A simple definition of doubt is having a duplicity of mind, not being sure. Two things are possible. Which way should I go? We have sayings to that effect in English, don't we? Have a foot in both camps, sitting on the fence. Many other languages and cultures have similar ones. The Chinese talk about having a foot in two boats. You ever tried that? I remember once when I was on a narrowboat holiday, and I tried just that. You know, a foot on each boat. We had another boat, and you can all imagine where I ended up, and people found it hilarious, but I didn't. And that's what James is talking about in James chapter 1, verse 6. He says, when somebody asks, he must believe and not doubt, because he who doubts is like a wave of the sea blown and tossed by the wind. He's not saying he mustn't doubt because otherwise God's going to have nothing more to do with him. He says it's a dangerous position to be in. I've seen some of those sailing things the other day when it was so windy. They were tossed about. Even Ben Ainslie couldn't quite go in a straight line. Well, they never do they really? But an even more interesting quote perhaps is found in Luke chapter 12. In Luke 12 verse 29, we read this. Comes from Luke's record of the Sermon on the Mount. He says, do not set your heart on what you will eat or drink. Do not worry about it. And actually, he says, do not doubt about it. He says, don't be like a planet that's just wandering around in the sky. Don't wander like that. Don't be up in the air. Don't be in suspense, not sure what's going to happen next. You don't need to be like that. You see, doubt is a state of mind which is in temporary suspension between faith and unbelief, really. It's that situation of, which way do I go? What is the right position for me to take, whether it's an intellectual position or a decision about the future or whatever? And it's neither faith, saying, yep, that's the way, I'm going that way. Neither is it unfaith, saying, I'm not going that way, I'm definitely going this way. It's in the middle. Doubt is not necessarily betraying our faith, but neither is it surrender to unbelief. Doubt is that position of indecision, of questioning in between them both. Doubt is at best a part of the thinking process. It's a necessary part of the thinking process. We need to doubt, if you think of doubt as being questioning. Should I? Can I? Should I believe this? Does it make sense? What is the evidence for this? You could say that's a doubting position, but we need to go through it before we become convinced of where it is that we are finally going to put our money, as it were. It's a necessary condition to reach a conclusion, doubt is. It doesn't mean that doubt isn't illogical at times, and certainly for those who've reached a position of being convinced of something, somebody who's not quite there yet can be very frustrating. Say, well, can't you see? Now look at the evidence for the resurrection. How can you possibly doubt it? Think of what the alternatives are. They're far more ludicrous than the idea that God might actually come and raise his son from the dead. But until you've worked that all through, we've got to allow people the time to do that. While they're doubting, well, I don't know, it just never happened before or since, why should we believe it? Okay, let's help you look at the evidence. Let's stand with you in your time of doubting. Luke 24 verse 39 talks about that, where where Jesus is talking to his disciples, 24 verse 39. And it's actually Luke's account of what happened, probably the time that that Thomas was there. And while Luke doesn't refer to Thomas, it's very much the same situation he's talking about. And they are startled, frightened. They think they see a ghost when Jesus appears in their midst. And he says, "Why are you troubled? Why did doubts arise in your minds? Look at my hands and my feet. It's I myself. Touch me and see. A ghost doesn't have flesh and bones, as you see I have." He doesn't say you're wrong to doubt, really. He's saying, why doubt? Look at the evidence. Once you see the evidence, you will understand that you can believe this and it makes sense. Unbelief is different. Unbelief is when we've considered something and said, no, I won't accept that. Doubt is a state of, unbelief is a state of mind which has closed itself to God. It's the consequence of a settled choice. I will not believe. So if we accept that principle, then how should we react? Well, I think we've got to beware of two extreme positions. One is of being too hard on doubt. We can so easily end up saying that a doubt-free faith is the only genuine and acceptable one. We feel guilty at the slightest question which arises in our walk of the faith. So we hear people telling us, just have faith. Well, perhaps that isn't the best place to be. Perhaps people should be asking questions. How am I supposed to cope with this? What's my reaction to this supposed to be? Illness or disaster strikes, suggesting that to doubt, to question, is somehow sinful. Or we're informed somebody comes along and says, the Lord has told me, and I'm not convinced of that, but when I question it, it's, how can you be so doubtful? How can you be so lacking in faith? And you think, well, I haven't seen the evidence for that yet. I need to examine it myself. However, that is to misunderstand that knowledge and faith, what knowledge and faith are really all about. Faith and doubt can in some ways be likened to courage and fear. The macho image is that fear denies courage and bravery. If you're frightened, you're not brave. If you're frightened, you're not courageous. But of course, in actual fact, fear is not the opposite of courage. Cowardice is the opposite of courage. Cowardice is when you see the problem and you say, I'm just not going to go there. You can still be fearful and say, but that's where I've got to go, so I'm going to go there. I've got this and that and the other to support me, and I think I will get through, but I'm still fearful. Mountain climbers, sailors, racing drivers, to mention just a few, know that fear actually helps courage. It allows risks to be calculated. Is this a ridiculous risk, or is this one that I can probably manage? So also, doubt doesn't mean the end of faith. It can even result in faith being strengthened and developed. Sometimes for those of us who've grown up in Christian homes, we've just been told these truths about God. And so when we get to teenage, and we've all just accepted them, that's what everybody says, isn't it? And then you get to teenage, perhaps, and an early adulthood, and you begin to question. And if you do question and you look at those things, then you come through the other end, if you like, as far as a Christian perspective is concerned, and say, yeah, that is what I now believe. I've looked at the evidence personally. It's not my parents' faith. It's not the faith of my group of Christian friends or whatever. It's mine. And suddenly we find that it's strengthened. Our faith has become real in a way it perhaps wasn't so real before. Doubt is perhaps only questioning whether God intends to heal on this occasion, or whether he might not have some other plan than the one that's been presented to me by somebody so confidently. Doubt will ask those questions. Is he likely to have told people to do that? Or does it actually go against what his word says? Faith is only denied if doubt hardens into unbelief. God can't. The poet Tennyson said, there lives more faith in honest doubt, believe me, than in half the creeds. And I think that's helpful. I think his tongue in cheek when he said, believe me, in the middle of it. But there lives more faith in honest doubt than in half the creeds. And how many people can recite the creeds? Well, certainly could a few generations ago, but wouldn't have real faith because they'd never actually question those things, just what we're taught. That's the way it is. Honestly addressing our doubt can at times lead to a much more real faith than we had before. After all, when you think about it, we come to faith through doubting, don't we? From a position of not believing, we have to ask those questions. We doubt whether our previous worldview was right. And then we come to a point where we say, actually, this Christian stuff makes sense. We've questioned, and our doubt leads us to the truth. We doubt the world's account of things. We question our values. We decide to turn instead to the certainty of the true and living God. And it's through questioning the experiences and circumstances that confront us that we are able to move on in faith, in the truth as revealed in God's word. If Paul suddenly turned up here and started telling us stuff, we'd obviously just believe it, wouldn't we? Or would we go to the Bible and say, well, it may be Paul, but let me check this. Acts chapter 17, that's exactly what happens. The Bereans were well known because they said, we need to go and check these things. See if it is as Paul says. Does the Old Testament point to Jesus as being the Christ? Or even Thomas. In fact, it's a shame that poor old Thomas gets called the doubter, because actually the word isn't doubt. It isn't the normal Greek word for doubt. When Jesus in the NIV is translated as stop doubting and believe, it's actually don't become a believer. Believe. That's what he actually says. Thomas, in a sense, wasn't tempted to doubt. He was doubting. All of us should doubt. Is this really Jesus? Could Jesus really ever have been raised from the dead? It was, don't become an unbeliever. Don't let doubt take you down that road. Look, there's evidence here. Feel it. Touch it. Know who I am. We're actually told to doubt as Christians in the church, and particularly church leaders, in 1 John chapter 4. Dear friends, do not believe every spirit, but test the spirits to see whether they are from God. Been in many church setups where somebody brings a word of prophecy and we all just say, oh, that's amazing. Where's the testing going on? Is this actually from God? We have to rightly doubt. Perhaps that's the best place to approach most things. Let me doubt this. Let me question. It's good in church meetings when people question things. And hopefully we've got answers and we can say, well, this is why we've reached this. And people say, oh, yeah, okay, we see that. It's biblical or it's logical or whatever. Questions are good. Doubting has a real place. Let's not be too hard on doubts. But, of course, the other extreme also has to be borne in mind. We mustn't be too soft on doubts either. And we can be soft on doubt by affirming too strongly that doubt is merely a helpful mechanism on the way to belief. While it is that, the problem is that more often than not, the issue is not so much how we doubt, but who we doubt or what we doubt. As I said at the beginning, the most vital part of our faith is the reliance and trust aspects. So a relationship is involved. It's faith in rather than faith about. My faith about the chair is absolute. Totally believe it, but my faith in the chair isn't really shown until I'm sitting on it. For the Christian, the central issue of faith is the reliability of God and his will. Can I trust this God that is being presented to me? And so the issue at stake is immense. Why and how we doubt might be interesting, but who or what we doubt is absolutely crucial. If the object of doubt were merely the Loch Ness Monster, I don't know whether he exists or not, or it, I suppose, it might be a woman, female, I don't know if they exist or not. If the object of doubt is, should I have a third cup of tea at breakfast or not, you know, they're not really crucial issues, are they? I mean, really. But just how seriously we take our doubts reflects directly on how seriously we take our faith. What is it we're trying to come to a conclusion about? So doubt might not be the same as unbelief, but it isn't totally divorced from it either. To continue in doubt, or to be content just sitting on the fence, loosens our hold on the resources and privileges of faith, and can all too easily be the pathway to the disaster of unbelief. Too many people get content in being doubters. They enjoy asking the questions. And it's possible to make your final decision just by saying, I will remain on the fence. And it's an uncomfortable place to be. Yet there are those who seem to enjoy it, as I say, who refuse to decide, like those on a journey who like the travelling but hate to arrive. Clearly, simply to accept that doubt isn't the same as unbelief doesn't mean it isn't dangerous. It's not a place you should want to stay. Some of you know that I've just come back from Zambia, where Carolyn and Martin, our daughter and son-in-law, are building a school in this town called Kapiri Mposhi, which is very much a transit town. And one of the guidebooks says, a place not to linger. Doubt's a bit like that. Don't linger there. Yes, use doubt to help you make a decision, but don't just linger and think this is where I'm happy to stay. It's a position we should always want to move on from, because ultimately we're bound to travel in one direction or another, either towards faith or towards unbelief. In the New Testament, faith is more or less synonymous with obedience. And the trouble is that often our doubts can affect our obedience to God. When we're in a position of doubt, we can stop being obedient. We sort of withdraw ourselves from the Christian walk, the desire for holiness, because I've got to sort out this issue. And that might be okay for a very short time, but how dangerous it can be for actual life. It leads us into sin, perhaps, while we're focusing on the issue of doubt. Because while we doubt, we tend not to obey. That great chapter, Hebrews 11, talks time and again of the fact that by faith they did things. It wasn't by faith they drew up a statement of faith. It was by faith they got on and lived out the Christian life. Doubt is therefore tackled in the Bible so often at the point of action, not just reflection. Don't doubt. Believe. Usually doubts are not argued against, but challenged regarding our obedience. Okay, you're doubting. Well, why don't you just get on and live? Get on and live the life of obedience. What we do seems to be, in God's view, much more important than what we know. In the New Testament, there are many strong words against doubts, as well as those against unbelief. And this is surely because since Christ, we have less excuse for doubt about those central things and the resulting lack of faith. So, okay, doubt might not be the same as unbelief, but it can lead oh so naturally to it. That's the natural inclination we have. So the matter of our doubts can never be trivial. Don't be content to be a doubter. Don't be too soft on doubt. Before I open up for any discussion and comments, which would be really helpful, I just want to make three final points. First of all, that there is always a personal dimension to doubt. Any specific doubt is as big and bad as it is to that individual. What is trivial to one can be gargantuan to another. I've never had a problem with the whole creation issue. I find it really boring to debate and so on, just because I don't have a problem with it. But for somebody else, that might be a major issue. And we need to understand that. You can't dismiss somebody else's doubts just because you don't share them. There are other things that I perhaps struggle with that others think, well, that's not a problem. Why are you worried about it? Perhaps whether God is truly concerned for us as individuals, how I fit in God's plan. All those things can be really big questions for other people. Perhaps what would God have me do in my career? It's important that we don't dismiss the doubts of others just because they aren't ours. And for any individual, their individual doubt needs to be addressed. It suggests that they are at a crossroad regarding their faith, and we can help them perhaps by pointing the way. So let's remember, there's always a personal dimension to the doubts we might have. Perhaps also helpfully, there's a useful parallel perhaps between doubt and sickness. Particular sicknesses can vary from person to person and from country to country. We don't get much malaria here. We do in other places of the world because of the situation of that. And we should seek to be aware about the set of doubts which are prevalent in our culture, that are general out there. Lots of people have doubts about this or about that. And maybe for our sort of character as well. Somebody who's a natural pessimist might have different doubts than somebody who's a natural optimist, and so on. And then again, we can't live in fear of every human disease, can we? Even so, we can't live in fear of every doubt which might come. We're called to live by faith, not by doubt, as far as that goes. But as those who travel to developing countries know, if they are traveling in infected areas, precautions are there to be taken. Those who are going to Zambia need to have certain jabs. And it's not a pleasant experience, but you'd be foolish not to, because the actual disease you might get otherwise is far worse. Of course, for most of these situations, the best antidote to any sickness in any country is found in healthy living. They say about malaria, for example, the best thing is just don't sit outside in the evenings and get bitten to bits. Use sort of, not sting cream, the other stuff, the stuff you do beforehand, but the repellents, insect repellents. Wear long sleeves and long trousers and so on. Just take precautions. The best way to avoid it is not to become an expert in malaria. Oh, I know all about malaria, so I'll be fine. I'll catch the female ones that do the damage. Unfortunately, they're the ones that don't buzz, so how do you know they're coming? You know, it's that sort of thing. We all know, don't we, the danger of studying medical dictionaries or handbooks. Suddenly you find you're coming down with every disease you're reading about. So we must do all we can to strengthen our faith rather than examine our doubts. It's much better to look at what we do believe than just get consumed by the one or two areas that perhaps we're still questioning and so on. Focus on God and his faithfulness, what he's done for us in Christ, and our faith will naturally develop and mature, and our doubt, our questions that we have doubts about will begin to feed into that. And perhaps just finally, it's worth saying that there is a difference between God and what we might call words about God or theological statements. There should be no question that our God is the answer to all doubts. If he is the true and living God, he is the answer to everything. He alone is the author and the giver of all faith. Therefore, he alone is the prime resolver of doubt. Knowing God through his revealed word and his indwelling spirit ultimately will dispel all doubts. But as individuals, as evangelicals, we also see the importance of those theological statements that have been built up over the years. The way that men have taken and written down statements about God. And so we can feel especially guilty if doubts creep into our thinking about them. Somebody says, well, I don't know if I fully accept the whole FIEC statement of faith. And oh my goodness, not allowed to have those sort of doubts. Well, we need to be careful. That isn't actually doubting that person's relationship with God. That is a different thing. Words about God are not the same as God himself. Not to say that those God words aren't very helpful. They're perhaps best seen as equivalent to a prescription waiting to be taken or a recipe waiting to be cooked. You might need to check up that you're not allergic to any of the things in that recipe or that prescription, but once you've discovered that, no, that is a healthy thing which will protect me against certain illnesses or so on, then we can take them. It's foolish to say I'm not ill, I'm not hungry, I'm not poor, if actually there is the situation with us and we need to take a prescription or eat that recipe. Similarly, it's foolish, I think, to just ignore those statements, those God words, as of no relevance and say, well, I'm just focusing on God. I don't want dry statements of faith. We can learn a lot from them. But the starting point of true faith is to see our need of God himself, not just what are the God words I should sign up to. So, doubts can be viewed as a friend who is asking questions. It's the friend who comes along when I perhaps need to look at something a bit more deeply. Perhaps questions like, what does my faith say to address this situation? Where does God prove once again to be sufficient when these circumstances are happening in my life? Why don't I believe that? Is it clear in the Bible or is it perhaps not as clear as I thought it might be? What does God supply to lead me to true faith in him?